This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
2019 was another transformational year for precision medicine advances in targeted therapy and immunotherapy, marked by some important milestones in the fight against cancer. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Today, we're going to discuss the impact of these milestones and their implications for 2020 with two experts in the field. Dr. David Parkinson is President, Chief Executive Officer, and Director of ESSA Pharmaceuticals. David, welcome.
Thank you very much, Alberto.
And Dr. Gary Keloff, who has for more than 40 years been engaged in cancer research at the U.S. National Cancer Institute. Gary, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Alberto.
I'm also going to recognize both of you as longtime editors for translational science for us at Global Forum. We certainly appreciate your efforts and the many articles that you and your authors have contributed to us. And as we do this time of year, we ask you both to sort of opine on what the advances have been in 2019 and frankly, whether cancer patients are better off today than they were a year ago. So with that in mind, let me ask you, Gary, the first question. As you review precision medicine and other advances in 2019, Gary, what jumps out at you as the most significant or impactful milestones in oncology and why?
I think the immuno-oncology data is getting better and very, very promising for many of the cancers. The number of trials sponsored by pharma exceeds now 2,000 trials. So it's a very interesting area. And goes well beyond the PD-1, PD-L1 axis to many molecules that are earlier in development and targetable. So I think you have to recognize that. I think second, the FDA Center of Excellence led by Dr. Pazder is really doing science-based translation and making very excellent scientific decisions, looking as much at molecular target-driven drug choices as much as target organ related, which is historically how drugs have had to be approved. Of course, cancer is a target organ disease and they're each different, but putting the molecular target up and then doing the trial sequentially, I think is very, very important and has led to a lot of successes. I guess last, I think the minimal residual disease in the hem-onc space, which is about 15% of the cancer burden. We've had some successes with ALL and written also on multiple myeloma. I think AML is ready to go and will be probably a subject probably in the future. But these other hem-onc diseases, we have a very short list of surrogate endpoints to support drug approvals. And the minimal residual disease looking at abnormal cells looks to be one of the very promising areas.
David, your perspective?
Well, I certainly would agree with Gary that from a therapeutics point of view, the most dramatic improvements have continued to come along the line of the immunotherapeutic approaches and the cellular therapeutic approaches. And looking ahead, as we'll do at the end of this discussion, to 2020, you know, I think we'll be trying to cover more biological characterization of patients receiving immunological approaches. That's one area where biomarkers have not yet, despite yeoman efforts, given a lot of insight into patient characterizations that would allow more efficient development and more effective comparison of individual patient biology with therapeutic strategies. So we'll see more of that, but I would totally agree that immunotherapy continues to be very high profile. It's interesting that Gary and I were reflecting on the 20 papers that we've been associated with. As you indicated, we've worked together for the last 2.5 years or so with the Global Forum to edit this translational series. And we were looking at the range of subjects that we had covered. And I think if you could summarize the strategies that we've tried to use and we'll try to use going forward, we've tried to allow thinkers to give us some insight into how this biological revolution around cancer and around the range of cancers that we see in patients can be translated more efficiently into therapeutic development. So we've covered somewhat the biology, a lot more the technologies associated with biomarker approaches and development. So we've talked about things like standardizing DNA assessment. We've talked about liquid biopsy strategies, including exosomes, Dhingra article, proteomics, the Arizona State article. We've talked about quality of care issues, and Gary's been, you know, really a central thinker in this area and contributor in this area. we put in the article by Stan Hamilton from MD Anderson about the importance of the quality of tissue samples and the fact that without high quality tissue samples, frankly, the best technologies still could be misleading or inaccurate. As we've reflected on the series of papers that we've published, and we can comment perhaps later on about that series in the context of some of the clinical discussions, we've tried to point out to people where we see the field moving, where we see the sticking points, where biological understanding is absolutely necessary for more efficient therapeutic development, but also for more efficient clinical decision making. And you know, as we get further into this discussion, maybe we can comment on the articles that we've put in so far and potential articles that we'd either like to receive or will solicit around how to analyze all of these approaches and make sense of them, converting data into knowledge. So a bit of a long answer, but there have continued to be seminal advances in 2019. We've tried to reflect those, but we've tried to do it in the context of the longer series where we talk about biology into therapeutics, because that's the essence of what precision medicine or translational medicine is.
And we certainly appreciate that, as our readers do. A few moments ago, David, you sounded a bit disappointed in perhaps lack of progress in biomarkers, if I understood you correctly. Was that right? And if so, what is the nature of that disappointment and what more could be done in the area of biomarkers to pay off their promise?
This is specifically, Alberto, with reference to the characterization of the immunological system of patients, of the immune status of tumors, of the likelihood or not of patients responding to immune strategies for treatment. And I mention that in the context from my perspective as a drug developer that, you know, increasingly what we've seen in a lot of the solid tumor settings in particular, well, no, I extend that to heme malignancies, as Gary alluded to, is the fact that being able to characterize a biologically susceptible patient to interruption of a particular biology allows you to do more efficient drug development, which ultimately translates into more effective malignancy treatment. We haven't gotten there yet with respect to the immune system. For example, the huge gain that we've seen with the anti-PD-1 and PD-L1 therapeutics with the antibodies, the checkpoint inhibitors, that was a giant step up in immune approaches to cancer therapy. We've kind of, I would suggest, reached a bit of a plateau with that. To get to the next plateau, it's pretty clear the biology is complicated, that combination strategies will be necessary, and that we have not got the immunobiological insight into how to do this efficiently. There are thousands of clinical trials of initial immune agents, checkpoint inhibitors of various types. Combination therapy studies are underway, but there's not a deep understanding of the relationship of, for example, PD-1 expression with therapeutic responses or MSI of a mutational burden with respect to immune responses. There are many clues, but those tools are not yet complete enough to help us be efficient in our development. That's what I was referring to, Alberto, and it was more specifically around the immunotherapeutic space.
So in order to close this gap a little bit, is it a matter of time and continuous research, or is it a matter of making a quantum leap in understanding? What is going to be necessary? You know, the passage of time, or actually a totally new kind of understanding?
I think the clonal heterogeneity of invasive disease under pressure of an effective therapy becomes ineffective, as we've seen resistance, and being able to characterize that new clone or the ability to measure how the patient is not responding requires, in some cases, invasive procedures, which are sometimes difficult, sometimes they're impossible. And so I think per David's comment on understanding the disease better, the biology, I think that technology sort of is helping to meet the challenge by being able to measure biomarkers less invasively and with more sensitivity. Alberto, I think that is a multi-year problem, but it is showing progress each year. And if you move earlier in disease where you have less clonal heterogeneity, you have other hurdles that we won't discuss necessarily today, but there is much economics as anything else because it's hard to get the trials done before the patent lives that exist expire, and there's no good surrogate endpoints in early disease. So it's a very, very interesting area, but one that's going to take a few years to solve.
Gary, let me stay with you on that, given that it will take a few years, as you just said, and given that everybody is all excited about AI in lots of different ways and for different reasons. In the era of artificial intelligence and other advanced technologies, can these technologies actually accelerate and shorten the several-year time span that you've just referred to using, I don't know, advanced analysis algorithms, machine learning, deep learning for important problems in cancer?
Well, I think definitely this is a field that's alive and well and growing. I think the machine learning techniques are getting better, and deep learning, of course, is maybe almost synonymous with neural nets. That is, it's a subset of machine learning, and you're using multiple parameters that give you more granular data. That having been said, I think in order to do that, you always need to match up what the machine learning is telling you along with outcomes. So there are a lot of trials in progress to try to work this out. And it's always a matter of is there clinical utility with what the deep learning is telling you? And that it takes a while to do that, but we're optimistic how fast it's moving. You certainly have a lot, like in the lung cancer screening area, where you've got an opportunity to follow people. But the longer you have to follow them for the clinical outcome, the more difficult and expensive it becomes to make progress rapidly.
At DNCI, Gary, are you all applying AI and machine learning, deep learning to cancer in some ways that you might tell us about?
There is a lot of folks that are looking at thousands of lesions, and then where they have outcomes, they're trying to see which computer-assisted image analysis will call an outcome. So you have many parameters, whether it's nuclear size or variation in size, shape, or stain uptake. There are a lot of things that the computer-assisted image analysis and different machine learning techniques can bring to bear on this, with the idea that structure recapitulates function, and that there are subtle structural features that are in screen-detected lesions or invasive lesions that can call outcomes. And it's almost a deductive logic. That is, you're not quite sure what you're looking for until you find the correlations with clinical benefit. And that is alive and well, but it's going to take a while.
Yeah. David, your perspective on this whole question of AI and cancer?
I appreciate Gary's comments on the general approach to artificial intelligence. It sort of leads into an area that I've spent more time thinking about and interacting with, and that's just dealing with the huge amount of information that we are now assembling on these patients. As Gary indicated, it's not enough just to look at one set of parameters. You know, we used to talk about analytes and individual analytes in the context of measuring something about a patient with cancer. We're now talking about terabytes of information related to transcriptomic sequencing. And so we put out a series of papers over the last couple of years that deal with some of that, that deal with not just the issues, as I referred to before, of getting good quality measurements, but then just dealing with the amount of these measurements and looking at the measurements in their particular context relative to outcome after therapeutic application. Let me give you the example. We had that wonderful article by Charles Sawyers and Sean Sweeney about the AACR project, Project Genie. And, you know, that project has now deep sequenced, you know, more than 80,000 individual patients with cancer, each one of whom was treated with a targeted anti-cancer agent. Now, the clinical data has not been assembled for all of these patients, but this is a way of translating information that's basically data into operative or actionable clinical information, which is clinical knowledge. To the extent that artificial intelligence can be useful, that's terrific. To the extent that new data management systems for this huge amount of data, new analytic systems or bioinformatics systems to reduce that data to something that we can actually understand and that individual physicians will be able to act on, I think is a huge challenge. And we've tried to address that with some of the articles. There will be more, I would predict, over the next year.
So are you saying, David, basically that the data mining capabilities that AI can afford can unlock answers that may already be in the data and that we have not yet been able to get at? Is that more or less correct?
I, I think that's an insightful comment, Alberto. You know, basically, we started off talking about actionable genes, you know, with limited sequencing and finding particular mutations that might be associated with particular susceptibilities. I think as we look further, we understand, first of all, that just having a mutation doesn't absolutely mean that the patient will respond. That mutation has to be looked at in the context of other biological changes. In addition, we also understand that greater sequencing, more structural information, if you will, gives us more insight. But in the future, I would predict, and we will have articles on this in the future, that functional characterization, biological characterization of whole cancer cells in individual patients will give us probably the kind of level of information we need for the ultimately most accurate kind of prediction.
Now, so far, you both have touched briefly on clinical applications, so let's dive into that. David, let me start with you. Clinical research, as we all know, faces many challenges, from enrolling clinical trials to rapidly rising drug development costs and, of course, high failure rates, even in randomized clinical trials. So these are all challenges we're all familiar with. So the question is, are there any novel approaches that you've seen specifically in cancer drug development that can address or will address these challenges with any degree of success?
Well, Alberto, you've put your finger on a huge area of challenge of inefficiency in the translation of this new biology that we've talked about into new therapeutics, and that is the clinical trial process. It is inefficient at many, many levels, and you've touched on some of those. We've tried to indicate to our readers some of the areas in which people are giving more thought. For example, in this month's issue of the Global Forum, there's a fascinating article from Tito Fojo, Susan Bates, and their colleagues about the potential for looking at novel external controls. The ultimate goal of clinical research has traditionally been the conduct of randomized clinical trials. The trials were as large as people felt was necessary relative to show a particular amount of therapeutic benefit, relative to our relative lack of understanding of the biology of individual tumors, that is to make up for the imbalances that we believe might exist in the two arms. And while that is, you know, a noble goal, and we've used it for 40 years now, or 50 years in clinical research, the fact of the matter is there are so many new agents being introduced. Thousands of clinical trials that I refer to just in the immuno-oncology space alone. We need to try to find more efficient strategies. What could that be? That could be better endpoints, and the FDA has been very active in working with the NIH, NCI, and the academic as well as industry community in trying to find those. The Biomarkers Consortium that Gary leads has been very active in that regard. So that's one thing. More efficient identification of endpoints that could be used for shorter clinical trials that nevertheless are accurately predicting ultimate clinical benefit. Another one would be the use of biomarkers to characterize patient populations. So you can focus these increasingly targeted agents on particular patient populations that are likely to benefit and exclude patient populations unlikely to benefit. And we've had nice articles. Bruce Johnson had one in the context of non-small cell lung cancer within the last year. But this article that I referred to by Tito Fojo, I found it absolutely fascinating because what they were looking at across is all tumors, and it was, what about the use of an external control arm that compares the tumor growth rates or shrinkage rates under your particular therapy with what would be expected in a control arm? I don't know whether that'll ultimately be practical or not, but it was certainly innovative. It stimulated my thinking. It relates to some work that's been done in the past with kinetics of PSA and in prostate cancer, some of the other work that's been done in the past. So I found it absolutely fascinating. But in summary, clinical trials need to become more efficient, and there are many ways in which they can become more efficient. And the clinical trial process and bureaucracy need to become less expensive and more likely to represent real world application of the therapeutics. There's historically been a criticism that clinical trials for registration of drugs for the FDA are conducted in a very artificial environment and one that may not relate to the extent of benefit that might exist in a real world population outside of the very tightly controlled registration directed clinical trial process.
Gary, from inside the NCI, how do you see the clinical research process, and how do David's comments resonate with you?
Right on target, as usual, David. I think the master protocol that has the ability to provide a template for a protocol, and then you can add agents to it, that was Dr. Woodcock's thought maybe 10 years ago. And it's really made the process of trial conduct more efficient. And as you get molecular targeted characterization of any single patient, you can then put them into different arms of the trial and ask a specific pharma company or companies to compete for the drug that would work at that target organ. So what that means is that you can have four or five drugs from four or five different pharma companies under one master protocol, and it really provides a lot of efficiencies. The I-SPY 2 trial, which David and I have both overseen, is a really good example of that, and you see more of these kind of designs. So for efficiency, that's certainly one. I think Tito Fojo's work is superior. He's a superior fellow, and with Susan Bates in this article, as David mentioned last month, was superior. I also really became aware that he's been working on a lot of trials through the VA system that they have with an agreement. So he's got hard data, and he's bright enough to make the right interpretations. I'm sure the FDA is looking at the advantages and disadvantages of external controls. Certainly, you have some dilution of the rigor randomization, but you get such efficiencies. And also, as cancer becomes more of a rare disease because it's molecular defined, these kind of historical controls really become important. I'd say last and third, maybe the expansion trials that we've seen particular in the immuno-oncology space, where you get initial efficacy and then you sort of expand the trial even to involve different target organs. The PD-1 was characterized that way, and you had a lot of learning under one trial umbrella that continued to expand and was not cast in stone from the beginning. I would say those are three areas that really make the trial process, I think, more efficient and more coming as well.
Well, we've covered the past right up through 2019. Let's move a little bit further into the future, into 2020. I'd like to ask you both, maybe starting with Gary, what translational science and precision medicine topics will be top of mind in 2020?
There's rare cancers, a rare disease when it's genetically determined, and David mentioned Charles Sawyer's superior work. I think the long tail that they published, really you've got a situation where maybe 1-2% of cases fall into a molecular targeted definition. So you really need 100,000 patients or so, as they are doing with their tremendous activity through AACR, to work on that. That's important. You have also the interest from pharma, where they have new uses for proven drugs, and they've made available for rare diseases, which are very difficult for the economics to be met with very low incidence diseases. In the NCATS, Chris Austin here, I think, is working that problem very hard, and has benefited from, I think, the contribution from pharma to give drug available for repurposing drug. We wrote a paper with George Vanderwood many years ago called Old Drugs, New Tricks. And it was along this kind of theme that there were some other activities that drugs may have that for purposes of the initial approval were not explored, and they are being explored now. So I say repurposing drugs, we certainly want to do something in 2020. I think understanding the microbiome, since a lot of work has been done, but more needs to be done in terms of understanding these 10 or so molecular targets besides PD-1, and just understand, as David said, why some target organs are responding, others don't. Third, I think epigenetics. I think that you have more and more data that the proteins carry out the biology, and that there are proven cases, like for rheumatoid arthritis, where you can look at the proteomic profiles and decide which patients are going to benefit from methotrexate from those that are not. I mean, that's an example of being able to predict ahead of time with proteomics and epigenetics which patients need to be enrolled to a given trial and which not. I think that's one. I think there's more on the master protocols. I think that the FDA with their 21st century cures is becoming many even more focused on test retests of new tests, and that CDRH and CDER are working very closely together to do good regulatory science. I think there's more on big data, as we've talked about, much more to come. And finally, I would say that as we started this discussion, as David said, as you get along with treatment, the biomarkers have not been as valuable or is available to monitor why patients are quit responding. It's the sort of the chronic monitoring that would allow you to change therapies because you have a biological reason to do that. Well, the fine needle aspiration technology, which allow interventional radiologists to pull a few cells as opposed to going back and biopsying and destroying a lesion that you need to follow, that kind of technology and the sensitivity getting better and better. And I think 2020, that will be an area that is less invasive sampling of tumors to give insights of when you have to change therapy and when you're okay to go ahead. Those are some thoughts for 2020 that I had.
Thank you, Gary. David, your turn. What do you think?
Well, I would just pick up on that and say that, you know, I think we recognize now that cancer is a complex system. And so I think you can expect to see over the next year articles that address that, of looking beyond structure, that is, for example, beyond the genomic sequencing into transcriptomic sequencing, into RNA analysis, assays that get closer and closer to the relevant biology that underlies therapeutic response or resistance. To Gary's point, I indicated in one of my previous lives that, you know, measuring static biology, you know, might be 1x. Measuring a biology in a functional setting gives you much, much more information, that is, in living cells. And then measuring an individual patient's cell populations as they respond and ultimately become resistant over time, that new dimension gives you almost priceless information. So I think we'll try to bring to our audience papers that reflect this, that reflect distilling the complexity of biology into therapeutic strategies, understanding how those therapeutic strategies succeed or may ultimately fail, understand how that translates into combination therapeutics. You're going to see, I think Gary addressed a lot of the areas, but we'll look at both methodological improvements, but deeper biological understanding and how those things go together with the technological improvements that we've discussed to give us a better understanding of how better to treat patients and how better to develop new therapeutics. So it should be a very interesting year.
Do you both expect that a year from now, our conversation will be materially different than what it is today?
If it's not, we haven't done our job and the field hasn't done its job, but I'm pretty confident, Alberto, that we can say, Yes, you haven't seen anything yet.
Well, in the course of this conversation, you all have mentioned genomics, transcriptomics, AI, machine learning. Let me bring those four things together and ask you this. If we lived in a world where we all have our genome sequenced and it becomes part of our electronic medical records, accessible appropriately, would AI and machine learning by brute force, could they be utilized to look at our genomes as individual patients and help match us to the right drug for our cancer? Perhaps even more importantly, predict a risk of specific cancers by, again, utilizing AI, machine learning in genomics to basically allow us a predictive as well as a therapeutic range of decisions. Gary, what do you think?
I think the time is approaching where all of the data can be put in one place, and it probably belongs with the patient on his mobile phone. And certainly these different parameters can be brought together to make sense. For example, the Cancer Genomic Commons here that has been developed for genomics is now cross-talking to the proteomic program and also the images. And there's an attempt to get all three of these parameters on specific patients to learn better. I think Warren Kibbe was here that led, and he's now, I think, at Duke. And he was talking about cloud computing and a national research data ecosystem that he wrote about for us earlier this last year. And I think that's moving ahead. It needs to move ahead. I don't know what legislation might be needed or what other rules need to be changed besides just the pure science and technology of it. But certainly it's coming. And as David said, I think next year will be better than we are this year, but we are in a marathon and not a sprint. So it's amazing how long, and, you know, Bill Gates has a quote, you know, you usually overestimate what happens in 1 year and underestimate what happens in 10 years. So I hope it's not that long. Anyway,
this may be a marathon, but we have a lot of very fast runners in this marathon.
Oh, right. Exactly.
David, your perspective before we close.
Yes, Alberto, well, I certainly love your vision. I'm not going to give up my day job quite yet because I think it's a ways away. But speaking about marathons, but there is absolutely no question in my mind that there is much to be learned, that we have the tools with which to learn it, that the pace at which improvements are occurring is accelerating, because the more we know, the more we can act on that. So I'm pretty optimistic about the future, but I think it's quite clear to anyone that there's much work to be done. But I think we're on the right track. Biology into therapeutics, that's the future of oncology. And the wonderful aspect of this is that we are developing tools against particular biologies, and the spin-off of that goes into all therapeutic areas. So the better we do in oncology, and I think we've led the way with respect to this translational space, that gets reflected into other therapeutic areas and will help accelerate disease management improvement in those areas as well. So it's an exciting time, but it promises to get even more exciting.
Well, on that very positive note from both of you, I think we are at the end of our conversation together. I want to thank you both, Gary Keloff, David Parkinson, for being with us today, sharing your insights and really the prospects for a very exciting future for science, for medicine, for patients. Thank you both.
Thank you, Alberto.
Thank you, Alberto.
For DIA Global Forum, Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.